Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 8th, 2002, and today's session is entitled Reading the Bible with the Damned, Session 3, The Weapons of the Weak. It is presented by Bob Ekblad, and it is number EKB 2002-03. Let's listen in.
I'm reading the Bible with the Damned, and we're going to look at the question of the weapons of the weak. And actually, I titled this Bible study Jacob and Esau Behind Bars. What we want to do is look briefly at some key texts in Genesis 25 to 27, and looking specifically for how this story might be good news to people who would normally feel like good news isn't really accessible to them, or it's hard, really hard to get. Most of the people who are on the margins of our society, they don't expect to receive benefits legitimately. They're accustomed to being rejected by the powerful or used by the powerful, right, as employees or whatever. So in any way, they have to learn to survive by hook or by crook. And this is especially true for undocumented immigrants who come to the United States illegally and have to get false papers, false green cards. Many of them drive without driver's licenses because they're afraid that if they go to the Department of Licensing, they'll get caught, or the Border Patrol will arrest them, or oftentimes they have no Mexican identification, so they can't get U.S. identification since they have no Mexican identification. And so we run into this all the time. So if Scripture is to be relevant to today's damned, it has to be freed from this dominant way of seeing God is basically blessing people who behave themselves and cursing those who don't behave themselves, right? And I want to look at Genesis 25, verses 19 through 23. Someone read that for us.
These are the descendants of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took to wife Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean, of Padan-Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife, because she was barren. And the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is thus, why do I live?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. And the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples born of you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The elder shall serve the younger."
Okay. So first question I have is, who are the characters in this story so far? This is a basic question, but it's one that makes the Bible accessible to anybody, really, because anyone can find the characters, right?
Isaac.
Rebecca.
Okay. Rebecca. Who else?
The Lord.
Wasn't Abraham at the beginning?
Yeah, Abraham is mentioned, right?
The unborn children.
Okay, the younger and the older. Okay, now another question. This is a question that often, or is rarely asked in Bible studies, but it's a question that's really important to people with whom I work. And it's the question of who has the power in this story and who doesn't.
The Lord, it sounds like.
Okay, the Lord definitely has some power. In terms of the human characters, though, who has the power?
Well, Isaac prayed for his wife, and so she conceived.
And then he didn't ask for his wife. He took her.
He took her, yeah. Okay, any other signs that it's Isaac that has the power? God stands behind Isaac, right? God answers Isaac's prayer. What about the beginning, the first line? How does the first line of the first verse that we read read? We're looking at Genesis 25:19-23, if you want to look that up in your Bible. The beginning of this story is these are the descendants of Isaac, right?
No.
Isn't that curious that there's no mention of Rebekah there? It's not like these are the descendants of Isaac and Rebekah. If you look a little closer into the story, and you ask basic questions like how many times does Isaac's name appear versus Rebekah's, I'll just give you this information. It's Isaac's name appears 5 times. Rebekah's name only appears twice in this section. And as Juan pointed out, Rebekah is clearly seen as a weak, even powerless figure, defined primarily in terms of her relationships with men. You know, like Juan said, Isaac takes her. She is referred to as his wife. She's Bethuel's daughter, and she's Laban's sister. Okay. So, and she's also defined in terms of her inability to have babies, right, to conceive. And then if you look at when Rebekah finally conceives, it's as a result of Isaac's prayer. And at that point, she's once again acted upon. You know, the babies, the twins are the future descendants of Isaac are struggling in her womb to the point where she doesn't even want to live, right? If it would be life, it continues like this, why do I live, right? So who are the Rebekahs in our society?
There's also a promise of power differential between the two babies.
Yes, okay, right. So there's a mention that someday the weak, smaller, younger one will have power over the other one. Okay, we're going to get there in a few minutes. But just to move along here, looking at contemporary equivalents, one of the things I try to do in all my Bible studies is get into the text as quick as I can, but even almost equally as quick, I want to get into people's lives, right? Because otherwise people get bored and just start to lose interest, at least the folks that I read with. So who are the Rebekahs, the people that are acted upon? Who are they in our society?
Homeless.
What's that?
The homeless.
The homeless, okay.
Well, me, I could use me as an example. Uh-huh. I get took. Like Isaac took Rebekah, the cops take me.
Okay. So
I think the way you described the undocumented people earlier about like defining themselves in relation to other people, like justifying them.
Okay. Like for instance.
Not having any papers and having to have someone vouch for you.
Right. Okay. And just being dependent upon the coyotes, I mean, the smugglers that have to sneak you across at great cost. Yeah. Being picked up by the Border Patrol, I mean, the Border Patrol just grabs these people and puts them in these pereras, they call them, dog catchers, and take them off, and they'll chain them up and bring them down to INS detention in Seattle, and then they put them onto an airplane and just fly them right down to the countries, right? So they're often feeling like they're objects. When they asked this question in the jail Bible study, the first thing that people said was the Mexican people here in the USA, immigrants, you know, were the Rebekahs. So who are the people who have power over you in your life? Is the next question that I ask. Who are the people? Let's talk about that amongst ourselves. Who are the people that have power over you, Warren?
My DOC officer.
Okay.
My probation. We have some DOC, Department of Corrections. If I don't check in, she has power. She makes. If I don't need, I don't want to come to go check in once a month, she'll violate me and I'll go back to jail. So she has a lot of power over me because I have to be there once a month before the 15th or 16th and check in with my hand. So she has a lot of power over me.
Okay. Who are some of the people that have power over you? Or are you free Americans who are completely independent?
Your boss.
Okay. What are some of the other forces that have power over you?
Police, obeying traffic laws.
The police. Okay. They have power
insurance.
Over you too. Insurance companies.
Taxes.
Taxes. IRS.
Yeah. Having a son that's approaching 18, I think a lot about the draft and the fact that the government can impose a draft and take away the kids.
Definitely.
Come to commit a felony. they don't take it. I don't have, like, man, once you get up, well, done, I'm just playing around, but you get a felony, you don't get to go, and you don't get to go to war. They won't take me because of my felonies. So, in a way, I wouldn't want to go to war, you know, so, because felonies are a good thing, in a way.
So the Rebeccas in our society then would be, you know, would be anybody who is in a situation where they are acted upon, where they're objects, where they're not subjects of their own history, of their own choice, right? And all of us, in some sense, could find ourselves in that position of being a Rebecca. Who would be the Isaacs then? Who would be the contemporary equivalents of the Isaacs? Really quickly. This takes a little bit of getting used to, kind of going, thinking this way about the text, but I think it's important to get us, draw us into this.
Who's
government? Okay.
Who's grabbing the migrants?
Yeah.
INS.
The INS, Border Patrol, definitely.
People with political influence.
People with political influence. Okay. The media, advertising industry.
Bill Gates.
Yeah. Definitely. So anyway, let's look together at Rebecca's problem. Okay, Rebecca is back to the text again. She has difficulty. There's an internal struggle inside of her between two children that is making her life really difficult. She asks God about the nature of this struggle, which is unbearable. And let's see how God responds in verse 24. We've already read this once, but let's read it one more time.
And sure enough, she had twins. The first was born so covered with reddish hair.
Oh, is that verse 24?
Yeah.
Sorry. Verse 23 again. Read verse 23 again.
And he told her, the sons in your womb shall become two rival nations. One will be stronger than the other, and the older shall be the servant of the younger. And sure enough, she had twins.
Okay. What happens here in this particular story? Is there any kind of shift now in terms of Rebecca, her power or lack of power in this story?
She's become the mother of two nations.
Okay.
And God answered her, you know.
Yeah. God answered her. And also God said to her. Notice that the information that's given is only given to Rebecca. It doesn't say, and God said to them. So suddenly Isaac is excluded from the word of God, right? A special divine revelation is given to the powerless one in this story, and that power and that particular word is a word that is very surprising and really revolutionary. The word says that the stronger, the older son, who normally would have the power in the society, is going to serve the younger, the underdog, who normally would not have any power. Okay, so the underdog in the story is given a word about the underdog in her womb. So let's see how this gets worked out. How does this word about this reversal of power relations, how does it get worked out in the rest of the story? Could someone read for us verse 25 to 28? Or 24 through 28?
When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red. His whole body was like a hairy garment, so they named him Esau. After that, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to him. How far do you want me to go?
All the way to 28.
The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man, staying among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob.
Okay, so what do we know about these brothers up to this point?
They're different.
Okay, they're different. We have Esau. We have Jacob. Let's look at him a little bit. What do we know about Esau?
He's a skillful
hunter. Okay. He's Isaac loves him.
He's red and hairy.
Okay. Red. Hairy.
He's a hunter.
Hunter. Why does Isaac love Jacob?
He's the firstborn. Oh, no, Esau.
Well, that's true, too.
He's fond of what he hunted.
Okay, so he's fond of him because he brings him game, right? Loved by Isaac, red hairy hunter, brings game to father.
He's also an alliance of power. He's firstborn, he's skilled.
He's skilled, okay? He's hunter, but he's not only a hunter, he's a skilled hunter. Okay, and he's firstborn. What do we know about Esau in contrast? Isaac, or Jacob, excuse me, sorry.
He's connected with love by Rebecca.
Okay, so in contrast, he's loved by mother.
He liked to stay at home.
Now remember, he's loved by the powerless one, right? In the story. He's just been the object of other people's actions, okay? He's, instead of being a man of the field, he stays in the tent.
He's a quiet clan.
Okay, he's quiet. Now, one thing to remember, again, that also his name, you know, his name means heel grabber, okay? So he's Jacob. The term Jacob in Hebrew means the one who grabs or who supplants, who takes over kind of the grabber. Okay? So, since Isaac does have the power that Jacob needs, right? In some ways, he's like God to Jacob. In order for Jacob to really succeed and have the birthright and the blessing and to have all the power that his mother and we as readers of the text know that he's going to have, because he's the second born, right? And the underdog in the story is going to lord it over the one who has the power, right? We know that from the revelation to Rebecca. But anyway, Isaac's the one that has the power. If Isaac reflected God, you know, and was like a God figure, what would God be like? Okay. Now, this question might seem like a strange question, but there is a theology in this text.
Self-centered.
Okay, so why would he be self-centered?
Because he likes the son that resembles him the most. And he took his wife instead of asked. He's getting his needs met.
Okay.
And he's 60 years old and he's a father.
It's interesting that he doesn't really... Esau does not resemble Isaac. Isaac is more like Jacob. Isaac was someone who was brought up to be sacrificed. And then right at the last moment, an angel of the Lord said, no, you know, don't kill him. You know, ram is sort of given in place of Isaac. Isaac was the son of a 90-year-old woman and, you know, a very old man. I mean, not really a sort of the son of this vital, sexy couple, right? I mean, there's a lot of things about Isaac that are very weak, right?
Mm-hmm.
In contrast to Esau, who's kind of this hairy, macho hunter, you know, mighty man, right? So, I mean, it could be that, you know, that there's some denial going on here. Like there's a preference for the strong in order to deny his own weakness, right?
Well, for some strange reason, he doesn't tell Jacob, get up, go with your brother. You know, doesn't say anything here. I'm asking Jacob, why don't you go hunt with your brother?
Okay.
So there must be something hidden.
So what more? If Isaac revealed God, you know, was a God figure in this story, then he'd be selfish. What else could we say?
He'll do good for you if you could do good for him.
Okay.
But he liked him because he gave him.
Okay.
Maybe.
So he blesses you if you bring him something.
Mm-hmm.
Blesses, loves, conditionally.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well,
anything else?
He lets Pete Wilson know. Well, like you said, like back then hunting was like the main thing. So if you're like right now hunting compared to now, it would be like someone who works with Bill Gates, you know? And he favors the guys that are good hunters, and back then that's what the best thing you could be.
Okay.
So he'd be favoring, you know, the people on top.
So he favors the powerful, favors the skilled, you know, the successful. This is a God who shows favor to the skilled, the intelligent, you know, the successful, whatever. Anything else we can say? Is this a fair God? Unfair God?
I, you know, I This second one just blesses those who bring him some. I think that's a really American reading of the text. I mean, in traditional cultures, this is what you do. You exchange gifts, and I mean, a child, Esau, Jacob would have wanted nothing more than to give a gift to their father. We read that like a, well, if you do this, then I'll do that. But that's not how traditional cultures would see it.
Okay, maybe not, but I mean, he loves him because he brings him game, okay? It doesn't say he just loves him because he loves him. So, I mean, there is a basis in the text to say something about this.
Isaac favored him because of venison brought home.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear.
It's clear, but the gifts are the basis of the relationship. So, I mean, the fact that Jacob didn't bring things would have indicated something about Jacob's interest in his father.
Okay.
I think a traditional reading of the text would be that Jacob is the selfish one.
Well, maybe so. We just don't know anything about what Jacob, you know, what Jacob's rapport is with Isaac, okay? But yeah. All we're given is this information that he loves him because he brings him game.
Yeah.
Anything else that we could say? I mean, there's a few things that are pretty funny that the inmates saw right away. They said, if Isaac reveals God, then God is powerful, old, and wealthy. That works pretty well, you know. I mean, Isaac's an old man, right? And yeah, he's old. He's wealthy. Okay, so and that fits pretty much the image. The average person that I work with, you know, inmates, immigrants, the underclass in our county, anyway, views God as this big old man and this guy with a big white beard, you know, who's powerful, old, and wealthy, right? And fairly distant and inaccessible. Okay, so the other thing that the inmates picked up on is he says, look, Isaac discriminates. This is a God who discriminates, who prefers one person because of their color over another. You know, because we know that Esau was red and hairy, and Jacob was smooth, and we don't know what his color was, but this is a God who discriminates. Now, this pretty much describes so far what the street images of God are. Most people who are outside of the church, who are just wandering, you know, who are in our jails and in our culture on the streets, see God this way. God is a faraway God who blesses those who kind of do good for God, right? And isn't really helpful to people that don't do good for God. And this isn't just on the streets. This is in our churches, too. I mean, I think of my parents. My parents went through bankruptcy at one point, and my mom was saying, yeah, is it because we haven't tithed enough? And she was really wondering about that, right? I mean, and a lot of us, we wonder when something bad happens, is it because I haven't done something? Is this some kind of a retributive, you know, God who's getting me back now? Okay, So anyway, this is a God. Isaac reveals a God who has his favorites, who loves because of what is brought to him, who's distant, who's fairly hard, impossible to please. I mean, there's almost no way. I mean, if we ask the question, what does Jacob lack that Esau has that would bring him his father's favor? What is it that Jacob lacks that Esau has that might make Jacob desirable?
Hunting skill.
If he made money somehow.
Okay.
Well, the firstborn would really help a lot.
Okay, being the firstborn would be one thing. Hunting skills. He'd have to be a hunter. Being the firstborn. What else?
Have a skill that would benefit all the people in the family.
Okay. So having the right sort of skill that would benefit. We don't know if that's the reason. Maybe just having a skill that would give something to Isaac, since, you know, you've described him as selfish, right? That would please Isaac, like if he made baklava or something, a really good baklava.
You'd have to give up heel grabbing.
Yeah, you might have to give up heel grabbing, exactly. Okay, now what do you lack? This is a question that I ask the inmates, but I'll ask you as well. What do you lack to have the power to do what you most want? Like, what do you lack, Juan? What are you and the people that we work with when we're in the jail? What do they lack? What do you lack to have the power that you don't have, that you want to have?
What I see in jail a lot is they make their dreams too big. Once they go to the fields and enough people tell them no, they turn to drug dealing. And now they said some pretty big dreams. Next thing you know, they're driving brand new cars. Then they get hit and they're in jail. They lose everything.
Yeah.
But their first dream when they came to America, well, the United States, was to just get a normal job. But they, sometimes nowadays, it's really hard to get a job in Skagit County. Those green cards, they run their finger through them. You can feel the fake ones if you go across like that. A lot of people are doing that now, and they won't give them jobs. So they turn to the next best thing they think, you know, and start selling drugs. And the next thing you know, I see them in jail. And what's sad is they get deported, and I don't.
Yeah.
They have it twice as hard.
Yeah. When I asked the guys, like, what do you like to have the power that you don't have, that you want? And they said, well, in Mexico, it would help to be the son of a politician or a rich person. Okay? Someone else says, you know, lots of money so that I can buy whatever I want to buy.
You know, this is kind of off, but why don't they have ID from Mexico? You were saying they don't have Mexican ID.
Sometimes they're from very poor, remote places where ID is just not that easy to get a hold of. And so they just come here right from their villages, and they've never had their own ID, and so there they are. It's just like they've been transplanted straight from there, some remote place in southern Mexico into the United States, and they don't have a birth certificate. They don't have anything. Some of the people don't even have birth certificates because they were born in their homes and they were never registered for some reason. And that's really difficult. I mean, we do a lot of trying to get some basic documentation for people like that, and it's almost impossible. So anyway, when I asked the folks what would be the ideal if you could have exactly what you wanted in order to have the power that you wanted, the most amount of power, what would be the ideal? Like what race, what nationality would be ideal?
White.
And they said that, you know,
male.
Yeah, white would be better.
Everybody did say that day.
Did
you ask that question? I was there.
Yeah.
Everybody said white.
Yeah. And would it be better to be, it would be better to be American. It would be better to be a U.S. citizen, okay? And, you know, the white guy, Dominic, when he was in there, he said, no, not really, man. He says, I'm white and I don't have any power. To be white and have money is to have power, is what he said. But what do you lack to have the power that you don't have, that you would like to have? That's okay, you can admit it. You guys are shy.
Self-confidence?
Self-assurance?
Yeah, because, I mean, no matter how much money, like, I don't have any money. I'm 14, and I mean, I really don't. But if I had money and I didn't have the confidence that I could use it correctly, then I wouldn't, it'd be like not having it, and it would disappear to things that aren't very useful.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So self-confidence. What other kinds of things do we lack?
Lack the energy to get up sometimes and go for work, man.
Yeah.
You like, well, just like you. So enough people tell me, no, I go chatlet, you know, forget about it, you know. And I like so sometimes I need someone to push me, and so I lack my own I need the inner strength to push me myself. I can't always have someone pushing me.
So
and
maybe you lack someone to stand with you and encourage you and push you too, right?
That's what I need sometimes.
Yeah.
It helps to have things like a name. You know, a certain name.
To have a certain name?
Yeah.
What do you mean by that exactly? Like, you mean to be known?
Well, I'm a past. Well, maybe this wouldn't mean anything to you, but it would be helpful to me to have the name Preuss.
Why?
Yeah.
Why is that? Why would that be?
That's a good name for a Lutheran pastor.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I'm not Lutheran, so.
No.
Yeah. I thought Ekblad would probably be good. It's a good Swedish name.
I don't think that would help that much.
Courage.
Courage? Okay. So, anyway, when I'm leading the Bible study there, and people are saying that it would be ideal to be white, it'd be ideal to be educated, it'd be ideal to be, you know, from a social class, a higher social class, it'd be ideal to be an American, suddenly I'm feeling like Esau. You know, and so it's becoming apparent that Esau is leading a Bible study with Jacob and Rebekah. Jacob's and Rebekah's, right? The one who has the power, or even Isaac. Isaac is leading the Bible study, you know, with Rebekah and Jacob, okay? With a whole room full of Jacobs, right?
Mm-hmm.
And really, that's how I'm perceived. I'm perceived, and, you know, Juan's told me this before, that he thought I was a snitch in the beginning, that I was just there to, you know, to be a oreja, they call it, to be a listener, to tell the police on anything that I heard, right? I mean, there's a complete distrust of me, even if I'm the chaplain, and certainly of any white person, right?
Well, like I said, when I first met you, I thought you were there to get information from people, and everybody thought the same thing, because I talked to them when I went back to my pod. Well, how come they send a white person to teach Spanish Bible study?
Yeah.
You know, they made you bilingual for a reason, so you get information in Spanish and say the language to the cops.
Yeah.
That's what we thought.
Yeah.
But
does that happen? Has that happened to you?
No, not to me. Because I speak English, they always come talk to me in English. But to Mexicans, I don't know if it's... they just get tricked a lot. What I see is they get tricked off. The translators there in Skagit County, they're working for the state. And when they get their paperwork, it's Washington State against, let's say, Juan Garcia. Okay? So who's paying them? Washington State.
Oh.
So I feel like even my public defender's against me, too. So you got to make everybody... So you got to be careful what you say and who you say it to. Because in jail, I've heard white people doing it to each other. For example, there was a guy that killed somebody, and he told the other guy, and the other guy went and snitched, and he got less time, you know?
Oh, the guy who snitched got less time?
Yeah, they cut your time in half, but you don't want to be a snitch. You know, that's the CI, but they don't call you a snitch. The cops call you a CI. Sounds bad being called a snitch. So they call you a confidential informant.
And the people call you a rata.
Yeah,
a rata. Right? The Mexicans do it.
If they find out you're a rata and you're in the Mexican pod, we'll take you to a room, you know? I would still do it now, because I couldn't let that. Someone snitched on one of my buddies, I'd make sure we took you to a room. And it won't just be one of us, it'll be a few of us. And, you know, you won't be talking for a while or doing other things for a while, you know.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is. That's a jail system. And they'll never change it. You can't snitch, you know. If you fall down, you can get up by yourself. And that's the way I was taught. Some people don't need help getting up, I guess.
So when we get back to the text, was there any way for Jacob to win his favor from Isaac? Was there any way for him to have what he didn't have? I mean, was there any way for him to be in a different position? Okay.
Wasn't any way for him to be firstborn.
Okay. And there was no way for him to be hairy, or for him to be a skilled hunter, perhaps.
Should have pulled harder on the heel.
Yeah. There's no way for him to be firstborn. Okay. So Jacob is trapped, and the only thing he can do is take advantage of his brother, you know, which is what he does in the next story. He steals the birthright by taking advantage of Esau's hunger. And most of the people in the jail say, hey, there's nothing we can do either. There's nothing we can do. We're brown-skinned. We're Mexican. Unless the laws change, we're always going to be illegal. You know, we're just completely screwed, you know, what they say. But I say, but you have to do something. You know, what do you do? You know, what do you do to get what you want then if there's nothing you can do? And they say, well, one white guy said, we rob, we break into homes, we steal. Okay, and the Mexican guys said, we don't, you know, some of us don't go that far, but you know, we get false green cards, and we, you know, we pay a smuggler to get us across the border, and we get false Social Security cards, and we change our names sometimes. You know, if we've been arrested at one place, or the Border Patrol's carried us off, and when we come back, we change our names and we get identification under our new names, okay? And so, you know, suddenly people are in a way, I mean, they're just coming, it's amazing when people are able to talk freely about what they actually feel like they have to do. And at this point, we look at, I mean, I ask the people, well, do you ever feel guilty before God for having to do these sorts of things? And the men say, well, yeah, you know, we do. And most of the people feel like they're in jail because God is punishing them, okay, for doing those sorts of things. You know, finally, it's caught up. God's caught up to them. I mean, they're getting paid back for all the little things that they've had to do, the deceptions that they've had to do in order to come into the United States legally or illegally and work and just all the many, 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 many things, like just driving without a license or lying to the police, or there's just endless numbers of things, fraud that is involved in coming here illegally, right?
Mm-hmm. This might be more for Juan, but then do you feel square when you get out? Like, you know, the scales are balanced now, I gotta,
it's the,
or is it still something?
When you're inside, your whole perspective changes. So first of all, your first days you go through withdrawal. Well, me, so I'm, you know, I drink a lot. I'm an alcoholic, and I always will be one, even if I stay sober. Like, that's what they say. It's the rules of the AA. But what's it called? And there you start thinking clearly. You think about, you know, I'm gonna do everything okay, you know, boom, boom, I'm gonna do all this, you know, blah, blah, blah. Then you walk out the front door. That was inside. I'm outside now. You walk to the store and buy a 40-ouncer or something, you know? Everything changes, man. Once you hit the last door, the wind hits you, it's like someone slapped you. You're not gonna do the right thing. Go back to doing the bad thing. But, so, well, me this time, that guy missed when he tried to slap me, because I'm here. But I'll tell you, back in jail again right now. But it changes a lot. It took me, I met him, I've been with him for 8 years since he first got there. So I've been in and out of jail for 8 years. I've been doing so much time that it took that long, you know. It's kind of, I wasted a lot of my life. But you don't, a lot of times you don't feel that way. You know, you don't come out and say, yeah, I'm going to do good. I'm going to go buy me a tie and a suit and get a real job. Because you can't. You got hit with 4 felonies like me. You know, it's not that easy. You start thinking, you start using your crimes as an excuse to do bad things again. I got felonies. I'm never going to get a job. Chad, let's go start selling drugs again. You know? So you, what the, my mind, well, the Chicano mind, the people I hang around with, we use our crimes as excuses to do more crimes. And we keep it as a cycle. As we, it's all a routine.
Hey, where is God in that picture when you're doing that?
The crimes?
Yeah.
I pray to God I don't get caught selling drugs sometimes. Mm-hmm. And I still do it. It's funny.
When you get caught, do you feel like God maybe is catching you?
In that way, I feel like God says, "Why you did it too long? You should have quit like a week ago," or something like that. You know.
Yeah. Most everyone in my jail Bible studies feel like God is punishing them, and that God has them in jail. Okay.
Do you think that that's kind of in the churches too?
In the churches, I think that's true too. I think that most of us, when calamities hit us, we think that God, you know, that God has allowed it, or there's just a lot of confusion. It's the whole question of the problem of evil. You know, why do the righteous suffer, but for someone who feels like really they're not deserving the kind of what's coming their way, in some ways it's harder. But for someone who has been on the margins of our society and been doing all kinds of questionable things to survive, then often they feel like they have it coming to them. But they feel, that's where they feel damned. They feel like, okay, there's nothing I can do then, because look, I'm always going to be illegal, and there's no hope for me back in Mexico. And up here, I can't make it on a minimum wage job. And now my driver's license has been taken away. So how am I going to make money? How am I going to go to work? I'm going to have to drive without a license. You know, so they feel like, okay, I'm permanently just excluded from God. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason why people go back. It's just like, why try? There's no hope. You were going to ask.
Well, you sort of answered the question, Bob, I guess. I was wondering what your perception is as to what's happening when people find themselves in horrible or difficult situations. I gather you're saying it's not God punishing.
I don't think it's God punishing. And we're going to get there now. I'm going to have to kind of turn up the speed here, this Bible study, because we got a little ways to go. But most of the men and women with whom I work, they definitely see God as siding with the righteous, moral types. People like, you know, like most of us, right? And people in the churches, and they see them as against the bad guys, okay? And I mean, a lot of times we're in a whole room full of folks like Juan and others who have been to prison and, you know, who are here illegally in the United States, and, you know, they feel like, hey, we're the, you know, they admit, hey, we're the bad guys. I mean, you know, they know they're the bad guys, and it's not, no one needs to convince them. They're not trying to deny that they've done a lot of crimes, right? So anyway, people just see God as on that side. And you know, we've talked in the last two studies, if any of you have been here, or some of you have, but that moralism and heroism are characteristics of the dominant theology. You know, that God blesses the heroic types, or people that are morally upright, and who are following the rules, and whether those rules are in the Bible or the society. Most of us consider it to be definitely advantageous and to be on God's side of history if we're obeying the laws and we're obeying the laws of the Bible and living an upright life, right? Now, this particular way of reading is the dominant reading of the Bible. Okay, if you go back to early rabbinic readings of this story, I want to read you some rabbinic exegesis of Jacob and Esau. The tendency is to think, okay, Jacob is given a break in this story. You know, the younger will be over the older. Okay, there must be a reason for this, you know, because God blesses the good guys. So Jacob must be a good guy, you know, even though he's a heel grabber, and there's nothing in, so far in the story that shows that he's a good guy. He's just a powerless guy, right? And let me read you a few things. This is from Jubilees 19. And Rebekah bore to Isaac two sons, Jacob and Esau. And Jacob was a smooth and upright man. Notice the upright gets added in there, right? And Esau was fierce, a man of the field, and hairy. And Jacob dwelt in tents, and the youths grew, and Jacob learned to write. But Esau did not learn, for he was a man of the field and a hunter, and he learned war. And all of his deeds were fierce. And Abraham loved Jacob, but Isaac loved Esau. Okay? So there's a number of twists in there, okay? And I don't have time to unpack them, but it's quite interesting. This represents the way the Jews, one current, you know, or a series of ways that Jewish people read these texts. You know, back at the beginning of the, you know, first, like, second, third centuries, right? Here's another one. The two boys grew up, and Esau was a skilled hunter, a man who went out to the fields, and Jacob was a perfect man who frequented the schoolhouse. This is Targum Onkelos. Okay? And because that was the tent, was considered the place. Tents were used as schoolhouses, so it was assumed that since Jacob hung out in the tent, he studied the Torah, right? Which is the next one. The righteous Jacob, this is Sifrei Deuteronomy, the righteous Jacob who observed the entire Torah, as it is said, and Jacob was a perfect man dwelling in tents. Now here's Genesis Rabbah, 63:6. When she passes by houses of idol worship, Esau would squirm about, trying to get out, as it says, the wicked turn away from the womb. When she would pass by synagogues or study houses, Jacob would squirm to get out, as it said, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. See, they were righteous. Jacob was righteous from in the womb. That's why he gets elevated, okay? And this theology is our theology, okay? It's the dominant theology, even in Lutheran churches, believe it or not. Okay? Because it's civil religion. Okay? Civil religion says that if you're righteous, law-abiding, good person, you deserve to stay out of jail. You deserve all kinds of breaks, success, everything, right? And if you're not, then you deserve jail, prison, poverty, right? Okay, but we completely separate our theology, our good Lutheran theology, from our civil religion, and that needs to change. That's my argument anyway.
But you're saying that we should separate that?
We should not separate them. Our theology should be the same way we view our society, ourself in society. Okay, if we believe in grace, then it should affect the way we view everything, you know. I think, as Christians anyway, you know. Okay, so anyway, let's look and see. These assumptions about Jacob's worthiness in these commentaries, and in most of the reading community, the global reading community around these texts, the dominant theological read, I think, robs these texts of their power, really. And I think a careful reading of the Bible with this dominant theology in mind, you know, the dominant theology of retribution, that God blesses the good guys and curses the bad guys, can help us take the text back. We're very conscious of the civil religious way of reading the Bible. And we see, and we ask the question, is that how we're reading it, or are we reading it for itself? If we read it for itself, this will help us, as mainstream Christians, take the text back and give it to its rightful its rightful addressees, you know, who are the damned. You know, people like Jacob. People like Jacob. This story was written for people like Jacob, who were the underdogs, people like Rebekah. So let's look at how, you know, Rebekah has the knowledge, right? And we know the knowledge that she has. The younger is going to serve, or going to rule over the older. Okay, the one that doesn't deserve anything is going to get everything. Okay? Let's see how this gets worked out in this story. I'd like us to read this chapter 28. And could someone read it for us loud and clearly? Or maybe I should just read it since I'm up here. Let's see how Rebekah does this. I mean, she's the one that has the special word of knowledge that God is on the side of Jacob. Chapter 27. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called Esau, his oldest son, and said to him, "My son." And he answered, "Here I am." He said, "Behold, I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your bow and go out to the field and hunt game for me and prepare for me savory food such as I love and bring it to me that I may eat, that I may bless you before I die." Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to his son Esau. So when Esau went to the field to hunt for game and bring it, Rebekah said to her son Jacob, "I heard your father speak to your brother Esau. Bring me game and prepare for me savory food that I may eat it and bless you before the Lord. Bless you before the Lord before I die."
Where are you reading from?
Genesis 27.
27.
Now therefore, verse 8, "My son, obey my word as I command you. Go to the flock and fetch me 2 good kids that I may prepare them for savory food for your father, such as he loves. And you shall bring it to your father to eat so that he may bless you before he dies." But Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Behold, my brother Esau is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. Perhaps my father will feel me, and I shall seem to be mocking him, and bring a curse upon myself and not a blessing." His mother said to him, "Upon me be your curse, my son. Only hear my word, and go fetch them to me." So he went and took them and brought them to his mother, and his mother prepared savory food such as his father loved. Then Rebekah took the best garments of Esau, her older son, which were with her in the house, and put them on Jacob, her younger son. And the skins of the kids she put upon his hands and upon the smooth part of his neck. And she gave the savory food and the bread which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. So he went in to his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I have done as you told me. Now sit up and eat my game, that you may bless me." But Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son?" He answered, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Come near that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you are really my son Esau or not." So Jacob went near to his Isaac, his father, who felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." And he did not recognize him, because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. And he said, "Are you really my son Esau?" He answered, "I am." Then he said, "Bring it to me that I may eat of my son's game and bless you." So he brought it to him and he ate. And he brought him wine and he drank. And then his father Isaac said to him, "Come near and kiss me, my son." So he came near and kissed him. And he smelled the smell of his garments and blessed him and said, "See, the smell of my son is as the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. May God give you the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and the plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers, and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you." Okay? So, what are some of the actions that Rebekah and Jacob did in order to get what they didn't have, in order to get the power that they didn't have?
They tricked
him. Okay. Let's look at some of the ethic. I mean, if we're looking at heroism, right? These are biblical heroes, Rebekah and Jacob, okay? So as you're preparing for your Sunday school class, you know, on biblical heroes and heroines, okay? What are some of the actions that Rebekah and Jacob used in order to get the power, the blessing, and the birthright?
They lied.
Okay. Let's include the first story too. Okay. All of the means. You guys kind of know the first story about the level soup, right? Okay. The level soup one is, you know, I'll sell me your birthright, and I'll give you some soup when the guy's starving, right? So what would you call that?
Extortion.
Extortion. Okay. What are some of the other means now in this other story?
Lies.
Lies?
I would say tag team. Well, they had to work together.
Okay.
So I'm not what you would...
What would you call that? Well,
conspiracy?
What? Conspiracy, that's the word.
Collusion.
Conspiracy is the official word, okay? If they were to be convicted of crimes, what would be the crimes that Jacob and Rebekah have committed here?
Fraud.
Fraud. Okay. So, Also impersonation.
Obstructing.
Obstruction of justice. Okay.
I got a few of those.
Stealing clothing.
Stealing? You know, I mean, yeah. Well, stealing of the blessing, right? Trickery, we could say, right? Mm-hmm. So, the inmates are very quick at coming up with and identifying all of these actions, right? The ones they came up with: trickery, lies, using false identities, counterfeiting, fraud. Okay, these are all part of Rebecca and Jacob's arsenal. And remember also that Jacob names means the deceiver or the grabber. Okay, so here Jacob is just living up to his name that he's been given, right? So, as we went through this list, people were, you know, people in the Bible say they kind of smile and they kind of look down, and like there's almost like this embarrassment, mm-hmm. and also kind of a sense of impending doom, you know, because they're used to, when they show a false identification to a police officer, they're used to, you know, when the police officer takes it back to the car and runs the name and everything, there's a fear, right? Are they going to catch me this time? Are they going to find out that this is a false name? You know, and pretty soon it's going to be impossible because of the iris scans and the fingerprinting of everything, right? That it's, no one's going to be able to just use false identification like they have in the past, right? But anyway, now there's a sense of you know, come close and kiss me, my son. I mean, everyone can relate to close calls and can talk about the many close calls they've had when they didn't get busted, right? And when they almost get busted. In fact, the guy that was going to come here to join Juan is a guy that three times he avoided getting arrested. He had a warrant for his arrest for something, not a serious violent crime, but just for a probation violation or something. And he had a warrant for his arrest, and three times he was able to use deception to keep from getting pulled into the jail. And when I asked him to come to Holden, he says, well, you know, I can't. I don't know when I'm going to get arrested, but I have to go do my time. I said, well, just turn yourself in as soon as you get back from Holden. Well, he got caught the week before. So he wasn't able to come up here and join Juan. Okay, but he's used to, you know, people on the margins are used to living that way, right? People get warrants and they know they have a warrant, but they've got a job. And so they want to make as much money as they can before they get caught.
You know what's funny? When you do get away with a crime, you know who you thank?
Who?
God.
Okay, interesting. So, and that's my next question. How do you think God looks at these kinds of actions? You know, when I asked the guys in the jail, how do you think God looks at these kinds of actions? I mean, here's Jacob and Rebecca, right? How do you guys think that God looks at these kinds of actions?
He's unhappy.
Okay. And that's the exact feeling that most inmates have. God doesn't like us because we're bad. Okay. So let's look at how God reacted to Jacob, okay? It's really important to keep going with this, and we actually have five more minutes, but I want us to read chapter 28 and verse 10, or I'll read it once again. And let's look at, this is God's first relationship with Jacob. He's on the run, he's fleeing from Esau, who wants to kill him. Jacob left Beersheba and went towards Haran, and he came to a certain place and stayed there the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed that there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your descendants. And your descendants shall be like the dust of the earth. And you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And by you and your descendants shall all the families of the earth bless themselves. Behold, I am with you, and I will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land, and I will not leave you until I have done that of which I have spoken to you. So what do you make of that? Mm-hmm. What does God think about Jacob's behavior according to the Bible?
Rewarded.
Okay.
Okay. Didn't mention it.
Okay. It's rewarded. Okay. Is it mentioned? I mean, this is a good question. Is it rewarded? Is there any mention of it? I mean, there is no mention of it, so maybe we can't go as far as saying it's rewarded. But it's not mentioned.
He's giving him quite a bit.
Okay, he's...
It is a dream.
What's that?
It's a dream, isn't it?
It is a dream. It's a dream. But it's the basis of Jacob's whole... his whole future. I mean, it's the famous dream of God's appearance to Jacob, where he sets up a whole altar that he calls it Bethel, you know, the house of God. And the next day, that's what he does, right? So it's a vision, you know, as much as a dream. So one of the things that I was I always ask the people to is I ask questions to see whether there's actual support in the text for the dominant theology, which the dominant theology says that God blesses those who are good, and so what did Jacob do in order for God to give him this blessing? What did Jacob do in order for God to come to him that night?
He had to flee first of all.
Okay, he had to flee. He was fleeing. What else was he doing? What was he doing when God met him?
Sleeping.
Okay. So far we're having a hard time finding, you know, very much sort of support for the dominant theology, that you have to be deeply pious, you know, and someone who's always praying in order to have God come to you, right? So far he's fleeing from justice, from the criminal justice system. He deserves to be in trouble with his brother, right? His brother has every reason in the world to beat on him.
But Jacob was obedient to his mother.
Okay, but was he obedient to God? Okay, and anyway, this is a good question. It doesn't say, there's a lot of what are called narrative gaps. Okay, there's no information about Jacob's righteousness. In fact, all the information we have shows that the means that he uses are extortion, lies, conspiracy, fraud, impersonation, stealing, and trickery. And it's the use of false documentation, okay? So if anything, this is amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me, right? And this supports that sort of theology, doesn't it? So God is different than people expect. And this particular blessing that Jacob, the bad guy, gets just absolutely shocks these guys to death. You know, at the end of this Bible study, I had a man that just came up to me, and he said, look, you know, this is just incredible. I mean, this guy wasn't a religious man. He didn't do anything, and yet God blessed him. And I just got to talk to you after the Bible study. I need to talk to you about something. I said, okay.
In the jail?
In the jail. And this guy came up to me. I mean, afterwards, like, everyone went back to their pods, and the guard. I asked the guards to talk one-on-one with this man. He said, look, I got to talk to you. That Bible study just totally blessed me. I was asked by the narcotics police to work for them, to be an informer, a confidential informer. And before this Bible study, I was saying, no way, I can't do it. But now I'm going to say yes. I'm going to work for the police. And I said, really? I wasn't feeling very excited that was the conclusion he came to, right, from my Bible study. And so I said, well, oh, interesting, okay, well. And he goes, wait a minute, you know, don't get me wrong. I would never tell on my brothers. I'm not a rata. You know, I'm not a rat. He says, what I'm wondering is, if I'm here under my false name, the jail has me here under my false name, if my family sent you my real papers, do you think that I could get a flight with those papers? I could get an airplane ticket? And I said, probably. And he goes, well, would you be willing to get me an airline ticket after when I get out? And I go, well, I don't know. And so suddenly his plan became clear. He says, well, when I get out of jail, would you be willing to pick me up and take me to the airport so I could flee and get back to my wife and three kids? Okay. So basically he was asking me to be a Rebecca. Right? So suddenly I realized that his view of me shifted from being Esau or Isaac to being Rebecca, to being the advocate. And this just completely changed my whole view of this text. I never saw this text as elevating Rebecca as the model advocate, who says, let the curse be upon you, it is upon me, my son. Okay? So what would you do?
Are you going to tell us what you did?
I'm going to tell you what I did.
Okay.
And then, and if you guys can bear with me for 2 or 3 more minutes. Otherwise, we can just go right now. So what would you do? Yeah. I mean, here, this guy is... Does he have a proper read on this text? I mean, look at Rebecca. Rebecca is the one that prodded his son all the way along to give Jacob everything he didn't have in order to win his father's favor. He gave him the hair. He gave him the meat. Or she gave him the hair. She gave him the meat. She gave him all the appearances of being the firstborn son.
His brother's clothes.
Okay, the smells, everything.
Okay. So basically this guy's going to lie to the police that he's going to help him, and then before he works for him, he wants to flee.
He wants me to take him to the airport and get him out of there so that he doesn't have to tell anybody that he gets out of jail, because he's got 3 kids who he loves, and he doesn't believe that the war on drugs is an effective strategy for stopping drug dealing, and I don't need it. I don't agree with the drug trafficking, but I don't think that throwing all the drug dealers in prison for 3 to 5 years is solving the problem. Okay, so I don't believe in the war on drugs. I mean, I've seen the damaging effects of it on the people that I work with, and how expensive it is. And I don't think it's effective. Okay, so I'm with him. Okay, what would you do? Here's what I told him. I said, look, I'm not courageous enough to be a Rebecca. He says, I would do serious prison time if I helped you, because I'd be aiding and abetting an escapee. That's a felony. Okay, so I'd be doing at least a couple years in prison. Plus, I'd lose my whole ministry. Okay, I'm sorry that I just don't have the courage and the faith to do something like that, even though I don't agree with you having to do this time. Okay, and I just felt so humbled, because I just felt like I was just having to just... I mean, you guys might think that's just obvious. Well, of course you can't do that, right? But... I mean, I've been working 8 years with folks, and I've seen hundreds of people go off to prison, and I've seen hundreds of them come back.
He needs a lot of support from the rest of the people in jail, too. Because if people find out in jail that you're helping a CI, a confidential informant, we wouldn't trust you no more.
Yeah, but helping him get away, so he didn't have to do it, right? But they wouldn't like him even getting out, right? They wouldn't even want him to get the benefit of getting out. Is that what you're saying?
No, but no. Just helping a CI.
Yeah.
You know, it's helping him try to get away, you know, just even... If the people in jail find out that you help a CI,
yeah,
you, if they one will tell another, eventually everybody will know. Yeah. You won't have a Spanish Bible study unless there are a bunch of CIs.
Yeah, look at that. See?
And there's not too many of those in jail.
But this guy didn't want to be one. He wanted just to pretend like he was one so he can get out of jail.
He was just conning.
Yeah, okay.
I think that there's no argument that... No. We are to side with the poor, as in like Matthew 25, and I can go along with the thing that God has a burning heart and a preference for the poor, although I think He has an equal preference for the affluent, because we can both equally be cut off.
Okay.
From God. I don't think you're saying this, but I think that deception in any form and in any situation is corrosive to the spirit and corrosive to, I wouldn't want to sort of say, well, because they're poor, it's more justified to be deceptive.
Yeah, I don't know that I agree with that anymore. I used to think that, but there's so many examples throughout the scriptures of deception being one of the major means for saving. You think about the midwives, who don't kill the baby boys. You think about Moses' mother who refused to throw a baby into the Nile. You think about, I can give you 50, 60 examples throughout the scriptures. I mean, deception is our fear of lying is a very much white American thing. It comes from, I'm not saying that deception's healthy, but it's not a complete no-no in the scriptures at all.
I disagree.
Okay.
I see Rebecca as kind of a neutral person. Like, God gave her that job to do.
Yeah.
And she accepted the consequences of it also.
She took a huge risk, and
but she was neutral. She didn't gain from this. No personal gain from
it. Yeah, she lost her son.
She didn't have gain.
And he didn't gain. He was separated from his mother, his whole family, in a way, right?
So in some of the cases where there's the deception that we've been talking about, the person hasn't gained.
Well, you think about Nazi Germany, okay? And this is, if you don't think deception's okay, I mean, try studying the whole, you know, the whole movement of resistance against Nazism among the Lutheran, you know, and other Protestants in the Confessing Church in Germany. I mean, I spent time in Corrie ten Boom's home in Amsterdam, or in Utrecht. Not Utrecht, I forget where it was. Haarlem in Holland this last year. This woman was a pious Christian, evangelical Christian, who got involved in this whole network of deception, hiding the Jews, you know, in her home.
And her sister refused to lie. Yeah.
Well, but she lied, and I mean, many of her family members, her whole family were involved in this, and as was the whole French church. I mean, the whole tradition of the French Huguenots, those guys, they hid Jews everywhere. Yeah. If you look at Chambon, you know, I mean, there's just, anyway, but that's a whole other question.
I agree. It's a fine line, and I don't have the answer on it, but I think it's also a fine line to condone deception too.
But one of the things that kept the German Lutheran Church, it made it easier for them to go along with, you know, with the Third Reich, were these very questions that they had a hard time breaking allegiance with the dominant with the system, in favor of having allegiance with God and with God's people, right? And this is a big question for the evangelical, I mean, for the churches today. I mean, I really feel like
love is the measure with that.
Love is
the measure. Love is the measure.
But Rebecca here, I think, is called to break allegiance because she's been given a word that God has chosen the weaker one, the underdog. She's been called to break allegiance with the powers who, in her particular context, were Isaac, you know, the patriarch, right? In supporting the one who was not the preferred son, right? And I think in the same way, our churches are called to break allegiance, you know. And we need to side with the, you know, with the people on the margins and with the damned. Otherwise, we cannot be bearers of good news to them. We cannot. We are not in the position to be bearers of good news. And in fact, that's why we're not in most contexts. It's because we haven't broken allegiance. And I'm not saying you just have to decide we're going to break allegiance. What happens is you get to know people, and you find out how complicated their situations are, how difficult their situations are. Like, how do you go and work, you know, when you don't have a driver's license, unless you drive with a suspended license? I mean, you know, you can understand why people do it, right? But that's one of the major crimes that people are convicted of in our country today, in our courts. It's probably the number one crime is driving with a suspended license. All right.
That's 7:30 already.
Let me read one quote to end this thing. Okay, it's not 7:30, 7:20. This is one of the Desert Fathers. Going to a town one day to sell some small articles, Abba Agathon, who's the hero here, met a cripple on the roadside, paralyzed in his legs, who asked him where he was going. Abba Agathon replied, "To town to sell some things." The other said, do me a favor and carry me there." So he carried him to town. The cripple said to him, "Put me down, will you sell your wares?" he said. And he did so. When he had sold an article, the cripple asked, "What did you sell it for?" And he told him the price. The other said, "Buy me a cake." And he bought it. When Abba Agathon had sold a second article, the sick man asked, "How much did you sell it for?" And he told him the price for it. The other said, "Buy me this." And he bought it. When Agathon had sold all his wares and wanting to go, he said to him, "Are you going back?" And he replied, "Yes." And he said, "Do me the favor of carrying me back to the place where you found me." Once more, picking him up, he carried him back to that place. Then the cripple said, "Agathon, you are filled with divine blessings in heaven and on earth." Raising his eyes, Agathon saw no man. It was an angel of the Lord come to try him.